It's half past eight. Half past eight.
It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike acts as host at a nationwide information please party. You furnish the questions and our experts try to answer them. For every question used, Lucky Strike will reward you with $10 in defense stamps. If the question is muffed, you get a total of a $50 defense bond plus the 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid, and all questions become the property of Information Please. Now light up a Lucky Strike as I present our Master of Ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, from its very first broadcast, Information Please has been completely unrehearsed and spontaneous, and we intend to keep it that way. Now, tonight, John Curran and Franklin P. Adams represent the veteran end of Information Please, and our two guests are the brilliant screen actor, John Carradine, and the world-famous conductor of the London Philharmonic, Sir Thomas Beecham. We're going to begin with a question from Mrs. Charles A. Green of Trenton, New Jersey. Now, gentlemen, I'm going to quote the end part of a cliché. And you are to give the phrase which precedes it. I can't do a thing with it. Mr. Carradine.
Just washed my hair.
Very good. Mr. Adams, you had no any alternative.
I would have said that, but I would have imitated a woman.
Go ahead.
I can't.
That was Mr. Carradine getting Mr. Adams out of a spot. Now, here's another cliché. The end of it, rather. You have gained a son. Mr. Adams.
And lost a daughter.
Well, I think, you see, the first part of the cliché is what you have to begin with.
Oh.
Now, what would the first part be? Just the opposite of what you said.
Same thing.
No, you haven't lost a daughter. You have gained a son. Isn't that it?
Supposed to be said in a marriage, isn't it? Or something?
Yeah, I think so, approximately. Look like sisters is the end of the cliché. What's the beginning of it? Look like sisters, Mr. Adams.
Mother and daughter.
Mother and daughter look like sisters, yes. Or if you were talking to someone directly, you would say, Madam, you and your daughter look like sisters. Wouldn't you, Mr. Adams?
I not only would, I do.
I'm sure you would. Here's the fourth and last of these. This is the end of the cliché. I can't lose a pound. Give me the first part of it. I can't lose a pound. Mr. Carradine.
No matter how much I exercise.
Yes, very
good.
That isn't
true of me, you can see that.
Yes, Mr. Carradine is a little inclined to thinness. What would you ever do if you were supposed to play Hamlet, Mr. Carradine?
Why not?
Your figure?
Well, he'd die.
He was very sad. Why shouldn't he be thin?
He was scant and fat. He was fat and scant of breath.
Yes, he was a little...
No, he was faint and scant of breath. I have
fat.
A modern emendation of that.
How about this one, gentlemen? This was made up by Mr. and Mrs. Richard Garrett of York, Pennsylvania. Both of them sent the question in, and if they should win, they get 12 volumes of the Britannica apiece. What scrap metal might these characters contribute to the war program? Let's get 3 out of 4 on this. Did you get that, Mr. Adams? Scrap metal? Brunhilde. What scrap metal might she contribute? Brunhilde. Sir Thomas, you know Brunhilde, an old friend of yours.
Yes. Yeah. Well, she wore a ring which Siegfried gave her.
Oh, that's right. I know that. What other scrap metal might she have?
She had a shield.
Yes.
And a spear.
Yes, shield and spear. Wasn't there a full suit of armor?
Yes, she had a breastplate.
And what did she ride around on? Sometime?
On a horse.
And what did the horse have on the end of his feet, Sir Thomas?
The end of his feet. Nothing in the opera.
Don't you use horseshoes in the opera?
No.
Well, why do they speak of the golden horseshoe then down here?
Well, I don't know.
That's in the audience.
That might be. Mr. Yeah. Carradine.
The golden horseshoe is that row of parterre boxes.
Good for you, Mr. Carradine. That's what I wanted to get. Yes, that's very true. And how about Maud Muller? What scrap metal might Maud Muller contribute to the war program? Mr. Carradine.
Well, a zinc bucket.
Well, wasn't it? Was it a bucket or was it a tin cup that she offered to the judge? What else? What other metal did Maud Muller have, Mr. Curran?
Well, she could have contributed a set of horseshoes, too.
How's that?
Well, she was raking the meadows sweet with hay. We hope she wasn't doing it by hand.
That's right. Her rake was iron.
Her rake was iron, yes, as Mr. Adams reminds us. Well, she wasn't using a horse in the...
Well, either way, she should have had some iron. Well,
you can't rake hay with a horse.
Heavens, no. The rake itself is the...
No, the judge had a horse.
The judge had a horse. Yes, we're not asking about the judge, Mr. Adams. Don't bring in these unnecessary characters. How about the ghost of Marley? The ghost of Marley, M-A-R-L-E-Y. What scrap metal might he have contributed? Who is the ghost of Marley?
It's something from Dickens.
It isn't.
I can't remember why.
Christmas Carol.
That's right. Quite right.
Must have been a clanking of chains.
Yes. Chain. Matter of fact, it was made of cash boxes and keys, that sort of thing, wrought in steel. How about Bassanio? What might he contribute? Bassanio, Mr. Kieran.
He could have given a lead casket.
Yes, from the famous casket scene in The Merchant of Venice.
Any metal.
Beg pardon?
He made comments on other metals.
Yes, he did, gold and silver. How about this one from G.H. Godfrey of Eugene, Oregon? I want you to ask to give us a line of poetry that might be suggested by the title of each of the compositions you're going to hear. There are going to be three compositions played. The title should in each case suggest to you a line of poetry, perhaps. Let's have the first, Mr. Kahn. Sir Thomas?
Land of Hope and Glory.
Is that what's being played?
Yes.
Is it the is that the same tune as Pomp and Circumstance?
Yes.
I would say Gray's Elegy.
Why would you say that?
And all that pomp and all that glory gave.
Well, sir.
That's approximately that. I don't remember the exact line. Can you give us another line with the pomp or circumstance in it? There are a couple from Shakespeare. There's one from...
Othello.
Very good, Sir Thomas.
By Pomp and Circumstance of Glorious War.
Oh, yes. That's the one.
Farewell, the plume, the armored camp.
Good enough, Sir Thomas. Now, the next one is perhaps a little harder. Let's listen to it, Mr. Kahn. What's being played?
Phoebus and Pan.
Phoebus and Pan, by whom, Sir Thomas?
Bach.
Yes. And can you give us a line?
Hark, hark, the lark at heaven's gate sings and Phoebus gins arise.
Ah, that's a very good one, yes. Thank you. Mr. Kieran, do you have another in your mind?
Well, on Pan.
Oh, how about Pan?
And Pan by noon and Bacchus by night, fleeter of foot than the fleet foot kid, etc. by Swinburne.
I like that etc. part. That's the part I recommend. Yes. Another one from Mrs. Browning. Remember that?
Sweet, 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 oh, Pan, piercing sweet by the river. A musical instrument by E.P. Browning.
Thank you very much. That's a 100% reply, Mr. Kieran. And now the third and last of these compositions. Mr. Kieran.
Goodbye, proud world, I'm going home, or anything like that.
What's being played?
Till we meet tomorrow.
Yes, good night, sweetheart. Yes, that would do. There's one which is almost exactly...
Tomorrow.
How about from Juliet, Romeo and Juliet,
Parting
good night, good night.
Song.
Yes, that's the one which would be an exact equivalent. How about this from James Snyder of York, Pennsylvania? Who bested his rival in getting the girl by accepting her proposal? There are going to be four of these situations. Who bested his rival by accepting the proposal of the girl? Is that situation unclear to you?
Unclear to me.
Unclear to you, Mr. Adams. Mr. Adams is always frank. I'm thinking Mr. Carradine.
Could it have been Paris?
Don't think so. The one I'm thinking of is John Alden. Because in his case, the girl did the proposing, and he was sort of forced to accept it, wasn't he, Mr. Kieran?
Very good. Why don't you ask for yourself, John? Is that the...
That's the one, Sir Thomas. Very good. Now, how about this? Who bested his rival in getting the girl with the help of seven professors and a garbage man? Mr. Carradine.
Gary Cooper.
Very good. In what picture?
I haven't seen the picture.
How do you know that's the answer?
Well, I read Life.
Good. it's in a picture called Ball of Fire with Gary Cooper and Barbara Stanwyck. If we had Mr. Levant here, he'd tell us the plot at the drop of a hat. Who bested his rival in getting the girl by betraying his own weakness? Is that clear? By betraying his own weakness to the lady in question, he won her. It's an old trick and a good one, and it was used successfully by Morell in George Bernard Shaw's Candida. Do you recollect that now, gentlemen? Does that come back to you?
Yes.
Mr. Carradine?
Well, he was, skip it.
Morell, who was supposedly stronger, actually was the weaker of the two candidates for...
He was the minister.
Yes, and by betraying his weakness and playing on Canada's sympathies, he won her.
Of course, he already had her anyway.
Yes, that's true.
Married to her.
Yes, yes. Don't spoil this explanation. Now, who bested his rival and got the girl by frightening his rival into leaving town? He frightened his rival into leaving town and so won his fair lady. Do you remember that? We have to get this right, gentlemen, because we have one wrong. I'm sorry, it's Brom Bones who frightened Ichabod Crane into leaving town, the legend of Sleepy Hollow. Does that come back to you, Mr. Adams?
No, sir.
It does now, though, now that I...
No, sir, it does not.
He won't learn. He just won't learn. That sends a $50 defense bond and a set of the Britannica to Mr. Snyder and sends us on to a question from Mr. E.S. Jones of Seattle. I'm going to ask you, gentlemen, to recite the entire line that includes these words. These words are all somewhat alike. Get 3 out of 4. The first phrase is, speak softly. Speak softly, Mr. Adams.
And carry a big stick.
Very good, Mr. Adams. Who said it?
Theodore Roosevelt.
Yes, he was quoting someone else. He said there's a homely adage which runs, speak softly and carry a big stick. Now, how about speak roughly? Speak roughly. Mr. Kieran.
Speak roughly to your little boy and beat him when he sneezes, for he can thoroughly enjoy the pepper when he pleases.
That's perfect. Thank you very much. Who says that?
That's the nurse in Alice in Wonderland.
In Alice in Wonderland. Very good. Now we have speak softly, speak roughly. How about speak daggers? Speak daggers. Mr. Carradine.
I will speak daggers, but use none.
Very good. It's from what source?
Hamlet.
Very good. Sir Thomas and Mr. Carradine. How about speak true? Speak true. This is the hardest of them. Speak true. Do you recall a line of poetry? If I tell you... I'm sorry, we'll have to count that wrong, but I'm going to give you a hint. It's from Tennyson. It's from Idylls of the King by Tennyson. It's the line is, live pure, speak true, right wrong, follow the king, in the Idylls of the King by Tennyson. Now, does it come back to you?
Yeah.
Yes, that gives us 3 out of 4. How about this from Mary Sue Miller of this city? Now, gentlemen, I'm going to ask you to get all on this. I think you should. The top news story of this week, undoubtedly, was General MacArthur's stirring arrival in Australia. Let's see how much we know about it. Can you tell us, first, on what day President Roosevelt directed General MacArthur to transfer his headquarters from Bataan Peninsula to Australia? Mr. Adams.
February 22, Washington's birthday.
Very good. That's quite right. Now, let's continue the story. On what date did we learn that General MacArthur and his party had arrived there? Or did we, here in the States, learn that General MacArthur had arrived in Australia? Mr. Kieran?
Tuesday, three days ago.
That would be March?
17th.
17th, that's quite correct, March 17th. He left Bataan on the night of March the 11th, and we learned that he had arrived in Australia March 17th. Now, in his first interview after his arrival, what did General MacArthur say were the instructions given him by the president? You don't have to quote the exact words, Mr. Carradine.
So he was instructed to attack the Japanese and relieve Bataan.
Yes, that's it. The President of the United States ordered me to break through the Japanese lines and proceed from Corregidor to Australia for the purpose, as I understand it, of organizing an American offensive against Japan.
And I think there was something added in that order. Travel directed is necessary in the military service.
Very good.
That's right.
Remember the phrase with which he ended his announcement, Mr. Adams? I came through, Mr. Kieran.
Oh, no, I said he said that he had left the Philippines, but he was going back.
Yes, I came through, and I shall return. And we over here have every confidence that he will. So far, Lucky Strike has paid out one $50 defense bond and one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, Mr. Cross maintains that there is a yardstick to measure the enjoyment a cigarette will give you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, a very accurate yardstick is simply the quality of tobacco that goes into your cigarette. The finer, the milder the tobacco, the greater your smoking enjoyment will be. For make no mistake, in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. That's why at market after market, year after year, Lucky Strike consistently pays the price to get the better quality leaf. For example, in Lewisburg, North Carolina, at auctions of the 1939 crop, the American Tobacco Company paid 31% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 31% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And that crop, properly aged, mellowed, and blended with other fine crops, is in the Luckies you buy today. Mr. Fadiman, have I shown our listeners that Lucky Strike means fine tobacco?
Mr. Cross, your very accurate yardstick proves it, and I timed you at only 58 seconds. Now, gentlemen, here's a very interesting question that comes to us from Jack M. Stein of Evanston, Illinois. You're going to hear a number of vocal selections, three of them, as a matter of fact, that are usually sung off stage during an opera. However, gentlemen, something has gone wrong, for each is sung by a voice not intended by the composer. What voice should be doing the singing in each case? Is that clear? I bet it's clear to Sir Thomas. Mr. Kieran, clear to you?
Yeah, but I won't know the answer.
Oh. As long as the question is clear, that's half the battle. Very well, let's have the first. Sir Thomas?
Tristan is older. Should be sung by a tenor.
Yes, that's quite right. What's being sung, Sir Thomas?
Hmm?
What is being sung? What was being sung?
The song of the tenor, the beginning of Act One.
Yes, the sailor song, as it's called, and the soprano sang it instead. Now, let's see if we can catch the error in the next. Thank you. I have two hands. I have Sir Thomas's hand and Mr. Carradine. Mr. Carradine.
That's the chorus of the priestesses in Aida.
What's wrong with it?
Well, it should be sung by ladies.
Yes. That's quite right. A tenor would be quite out of place, would he not?
I don't know. I might not think I was out of place if I were there. And then I'm not a tenor.
I heard different.
come, no scandal, Mr. Adams.
You're here now.
Now let's listen to the third and last of these. Thank you. I have Sir Thomas's hand up.
La Bohème.
I beg pardon, La Bohème. What's wrong?
Tenor song.
I beg pardon?
Tenor solo.
A tenor solo?
Not a duet, yes.
It is not a duet. Perhaps you didn't hear enough of it. Mr. Carradine.
I think it's a duet, but they got the parts reversed.
Yes, that's it. It is a duet from La Bohème, but the voices are reversed.
Sounds pretty to me.
They were good. They were good, Mr. Adams. How about this? This comes from Jack Bean of Hartsell, Alabama. Yet two out of three. I want you to identify these victims of vengeance. Now, in the first case, in revenge, it was ordered that none take her talk seriously. None take her talk seriously. What am I speaking of, Mr. Kieran?
You mean Cassandra?
Yes, I do.
Prophetess who told the truth, but nobody would believe her.
Yes, and why was she so punished? Do you remember?
No, I have forgotten.
And any of you gentlemen remember why she was so punished? It was because she spurned the advances of Apollo, and to punish her, he decreed that though she had the gift of prophecy, as Mr. Kieran tells us, no one would believe her. Now, here's another. In revenge, he pursued his persecutors until one lost his fortune, another killed himself, and a third went mad. That's a cleanup. Sir Thomas.
Monte Cristo.
Yes, very good. Edward Dantes, the Count of Monte Cristo. Mr. Kieran had his hand up at the same time. How about this one? In revenge, he was made to suffer a liver attack. Mr. Adams.
That was Sisyphus.
No, I don't think.
No, the other
think
boy.
It was Sisyphus.
That's right.
Mr. Kieran.
Prometheus.
Yes, what happened to Prometheus, Mr. Adams?
I think a vulture feasted upon him.
Yes, exactly. Had he done to...
Stole fire from heaven.
That's quite right. And Zeus chained him to a rock, and the vulture consumed his liver. And why... how long did this punishment go on, Mr. Kieran?
Eternally,
yes.
Immortale jaeco, as the Latin has it. The liver
thank
is,
you very much, Mr. Kieran.
Refreshed all the time.
Yes, it was a permanent liver that was renewed as fast as it was eaten. Now, how about this one from P.D. Rising of Needham, Massachusetts? It's a sports question. In what sport or game does the scoring object go through or over the following shaped scoring area? It's the shapes that we want to identify here. Get three out of four. In the first case, the scoring area is circular. Now, what game would that be, Mr. Carradine?
Basketball.
Yes, basketball. Can you think of any other? Basketball is the best. Archery, too, I suppose. The scoring area.
That's true.
The board. How about golf?
Yes, that's right.
That's right. It's a very small circle. How about a case where the scoring area is a triangle? What sport or game would that be?
Well, soccer net, the base of it is drawn into a triangle, I believe, in the back end, isn't it?
I don't know.
Triangular from the side.
I don't know.
Profile, it's triangular.
The example I was thinking, Mr. Thomas?
Croquet.
Croquet? No, there's no triangular area in croquet, I don't think.
The score to hit the stake.
No. A shuffleboard is played on a triangular sort of arrangement, isn't it? Ever play shuffleboard, Mr. Adams?
No.
No?
It's not.
It is not?
No.
Well, that settles that. It was a good argument while it lasted. How about a scoring area that is shaped like an arch? Sir Thomas, it seems to me, Mr. Carradine?
Well, no, that wouldn't be croquet.
Mr. Adams?
That would be a croquet.
Yes, croquet. The ball goes through an arch shape.
But that doesn't give you a score.
Well, it helps.
It's not the scoring area. The stake is the scoring area.
The whole area.
The stake is the goal.
You've got wickets all over. you only score when you hit the goal. You score going through
true.
A wicket.
That's perfectly true. You're splitting hairs, though. Mr. Kieran?
Splitting wickets.
Billiards is another. The pockets are arched. First bottom on the table, and also the iron bracket that is faced with leather is in the form of an arch.
I hadn't thought of that. That's perfectly true. Now, how
pocket
about
snooker pools?
How about an area which is shaped like a rectangle?
A rectangle.
Mr. Adams.
That might be lawn tennis.
Well, certainly the court is shaped like a rectangle. The object, however, doesn't go through.
Through a rectangle?
Mr. Carradine?
Football.
Soccer, I think.
Yes, that is.
Would that be right, Mr. Carradine?
Rectangle up front.
Yes,
I rectangle. Said soccer.
Did you say soccer? I beg pardon, Sir Thomas. Credit goes to Sir Thomas. Very good. And how about this one from Vernon M. Kuhn of Denver? It's about towers in poetry, famous towers in poetry. Tell me where you'll find them. My first tower is ivy-mantled. Sir Thomas?
Yes, ivy-mantled.
Mr. Adams?
I think that's Gray's Elegy.
Yes. Can you give us the line from which
save, it comes? Where from yonder ivy-mantled tower.
That's perfect. How does it go on?
I say that from yonder ivy tower, the moping owl doth to the moon complain.
Very good. Yes. How about a dark tower? Can you identify that for us, Mr. Kieran?
Dauntless the slughorn to his lips he set and blew, child Roland to the dark tower came.
That's perfect. You're quoting from what?
Browning.
Very
and
good.
And that's taken, quoted itself, those two lines from Edgar's song in Lear.
And where did Shakespeare get them, do you suppose?
He got it from the old chronicles, Holinshed.
And do you want to go back any further or do you want to leave it? Boy, what a genealogist you'd make, Mr. Kieran. How about topless towers? Topless towers. Sir Thomas?
Marlowe's fastest, the topless towers of Ilium.
Yes, that's quite right.
This remember the face that burned a thousand ships.
Launched.
And burned the topless towers of Ilium.
Don't get your burns and your launches mixed up. How about this one? This comes from Holger Koppel of Baltimore. You're going to hear some music, three pieces. In each of them, a conspiracy is being plotted. What conspiracy is afoot in the music that you're about to hear? Let's have the first. Sir Thomas.
Rigoletto.
Yes, what's happening as that music is
a young lady is about to be carried off.
About to be carried, is that it?
Abducted.
Or isn't the murder of the Duke being plotted to that music?
No, I think it's the abduction of Gilda.
Now, I have it as the murder of the Duke plotted by Rigoletto and an assassin.
No, I don't think it is so.
You don't think it is?
No,
there's
I'm
certainly
sure
no way of checking it
out. Well, it starts out as a plot to murder the Duke, but he foils it, you see.
No, this is the music just before the abduction of Gilda.
But at any rate,
the
there is
a plot to murder the Duke is in an earlier scene. It's different music altogether.
Well, as long as we have a conspiracy, that satisfies me,
Sir
Thomas. I think
it's enough, yes.
Listen to the next one. I beg pardon?
Carmen.
Carmen. What is afoot?
The quintet in Carmen.
What are they doing?
It's not exactly a conspiracy. It's a plan to smuggle goods.
Yes. Is that what is known as the smuggler's chorus?
No.
It is not the smuggler's chorus. Well, I seem to be thoroughly misinformed. The third and last. Mr. Adams?
They're going to, steal ashore and,
Who?
The, conspirators in HMS Pinafore. They're going to steal ashore and, marry the, daughter of the, captain to Rafe Rackstraw, a common seaman.
Well, I'm still misinformed. I have this is from the Pirates of Penzance. How about it, Sir Thomas?
That's right.
Penzance.
Correct.
Mr. Adams, do you want me to forget everything you've said?
With cat-like tread upon our prey.
That's it, Sir Thomas. Yes, but you did. That was a wonderful answer, Mr. Adams.
It was wrong.
I know, but the detail is perfect.
It's a gallant effort.
The detail on that answer was remarkably good. Well, I think that gives us, at least 2 out of 3. And so we will not send a defense bond to, Mr. Copple. I'm going to look up those answers that you gave us, Sir Thomas, because I'm worried. My information just differs slightly from yours.
What parts are you, I've just been conducting most of these pieces.
Oh, well, that settles it. I haven't. And now here's Mr. Cross, who confesses he's about to polish an apple.
Well, Mr. Fadiman, I want to point out that you're an excellent guide to follow when buying books.
Thank you, Mr. Cross.
That's because, as a book reviewer, you're an expert on books. And similarly, ladies and gentlemen, when buying cigarettes, you'll do well to be guided by the opinions of the experts on tobacco, the independent buyers, auctioneers, and warehouse men. These independent experts spend their lives buying, selling, and handling the leaf. And at auctions all over the South, year after year, they see just who buys what tobacco and the prices paid. That's why the overwhelming preference of the experts for one cigarette, Lucky's, means a lot to you. Now, let me just give you some examples of how Lucky Strike has won this tobacco expert's stamp of approval. In Greenville, Tennessee, at auctions of the 1939 crop, the makers of Lucky's paid 26% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. At Pelham, Georgia, 37% more, and so on at market after market. And that crop, properly aged, mellowed, and blended with other fine crops, is in the Lucky's you buy today. No wonder that with independent experts, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. We suggest that you smoke the smoke tobacco experts smoke. Just remember, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. And in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. This evening, Lucky Strike has cheerfully paid out one $50 defense bond and one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Sir Thomas and Mr. Carradine, Lucky Strike thanks you for the gift of your wit and wisdom this evening. Next week, the Three Musketeers, Mr. Kieran, Mr. Levant, and Mr. Adams, welcome as our guest Wallace Duell, the famous foreign correspondent and author of People Under Hitler. Remember, for every question that's answered correctly,